This is RevTech Podcast, where we discuss everything from business processes to measurement and technical alignment. The RevTech mission focuses on effectively managing and optimizing the go-to-market strategy through methodologies, tools, and best practices. We discuss the success criteria and technical fit guides for decision-making and ensure solutions align with the business goals. In this episode, our guest is Guillaume Jacquet, the CEO of ASCO. It's great to have you on.
I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, welcome. So let's get right into things. Give us the elevator pitch for ASCO.
So ASCO is basically the end-to-end revenue operation platform for SaaS businesses. So we take the best practices of revenue architecture. You may have heard, you know, the winning by design framework. And what we do with this platform is we empower CROs and revenue operation teams to implement them in their business so that they can implement sustainable growth and be more scientific about the way they go to market.
Well, cool. I'm very excited to see the demo. And so you're a co-founder. I'd love to hear how ASCO got started and what made you decide to start the company.
Actually, you know, ASCO is my second company. And it's the second company because actually, the experience I had in the past really set the table for me to think about building a product like this. My first company was a SaaS-enabled marketplace in the golf industry called ChronoGolf. Think open table, but applied to the golf industry. And we went through the route of raising VC money, three rounds of financing, and then successfully exited the business to a company called Lightspeed. But through that period of time of trying to scale a startup, I deeply experienced the pain of first learning what, you know, scientific method of sales is. In the beginning, we were really, really green. Like, we thought we're just going to hire a few salespeople and they're going to generate pipeline, close the pipeline, and everything's going to go there, right? You just need to hire salespeople and the product's going to sell. And once the product didn't sell, then we had to be, you know, a bit more creative around that. So at the time, I remember we embarked on the journey to really educate ourselves on revenue architecture. It wasn't called revenue architecture back in the days. It was pioneered by people like Aaron Ross, who's built predictable revenue and from impossible to inevitable. And Marc Roberge was also one of the pioneers in the industry with the sales acceleration formula and what it's done to HubSpot. And we really like went into that field. And when we started implementing specialization, measuring everything, being more consistent in trying to understand which channel was providing what kind of ROI and iterating progressively and building really the business around the customer journey, then we started to see pipeline generation slowly going up. And then it started to become inevitable. And then close rate shortly followed and it became inevitable. And then we saw the metrics and we opened up new go-to-market motion and new channels. And really, you could really feel that this next step was smaller than the first one and that we were building something that was progressively accelerating. And it really, it was a turning point. It's the reason why we were able to get a successful exit. And then we saw that methodology at scale with a company called Lightspeed, who is now a $3 billion company listed on the New York Stock Exchange and a phenomenal company altogether. But really, it was that core moment. And I remember vividly my VCs when they saw that we were doing that and successful at it. They asked me to coach some of their Series A entrepreneur, saying, well, Guillaume, you know, help them find and scale go-to-market fit. And the first thing I was doing every time was speak with these entrepreneurs. And I was spending the first 10 minutes to validate whether or not they really had product market fit. Because, you know, some of them, they're amazing at pitching. And if you don't have product market fit, then you don't build high velocity sales. It's just going to get you faster to a well. But the next 50 minutes, I found myself repeating the same thing over and over and over again. And it was the same things, regardless of the industry, the type of product, as long as they were B2B, it was very consistent. And I was, you know, a bit saddened because I knew that they would just retain 15%. And the one really who I was able to help are the ones where I was an advisor or on the board or things like that. But the other ones, I was missing the product, which would be that forcing function so that you can implement that methodology. Because otherwise, you know, it's actually kind of hard to do. And if you're not there every week, if you don't have, you know, some kind of map to get there, then it becomes very, very complex. So that's when the idea emerged. And then it developed in Lightspeed because I saw actually that when you start to scale, it's funny, but you you have go-to-market fit, but it's a challenge to keep it because you scale in multiple product geographies and so on. And something else happens is you go super fast and you lose the view on the customer journey. Your conversion rates per product, per region, per segment, you're overcovered, undercovered, you need to hire now. No, you need to stop hiring. Conversion rates are not cohorted, so you don't really know if you're accelerating, whether or not you... The weekly business reviews that we had was the time where the CRO and the president was making sure to really make sure that, you know, marketing was talking to pre-sales, to sales, and so on and so on. I was sitting in that room, I was like, this is math. This is math. Who has the math? And then, you know, everybody trying to justify the number because they want to look good in front of their boss. And this is where I realized that actually it's not just something for startup scale up needed as well. And that maybe means that if we can productify that, then we have a real market and not just a service company. And we embarked on this. And people kept telling us, well, Guillaume, this is a service business. This is not a product. And I believe that now we productified that. So yeah, a long explanation, but deeply anchored into a pain and an experience I've lived in. And I'm really passionate about this because, you know, the companies that can implement that, like they do have a higher chance of survival.
Yeah.
Because in B2B, go-to-market fit is as important as product market fit.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting that you've seen it from obviously that startup lens. And then as you got acquired in that larger company, like it's still hard. It doesn't matter what size of company you are. It's always a challenge to figure out how you're going to market and how that's doing. I have a very important question for you. Are you a big golfer?
I am an okay golfer. I was a great golfer when I was younger. And then, starting 16, 17, 18, I had other priorities. So unfortunately, I lost a bit of my game, but I'm coming back to it.
Okay.
But my brother, who's a co-founder in ChronoGolf, the first startup, is actually a pro golfer. So,
very cool.
There you go.
That was an alibi.
That's the connection. I don't even know what's going on with golf. I can't play this. For some reason, it's not my thing. But, you know, I went a couple of times with my buddies. I mean, they were just beating me on everything. So I'm just kicking this that way and this goes that way. You know, it's just not for me. I'm always impressed by people who actually can do this, like planning and step by step getting closer to that hole. So congratulate you to be in that space and having a successful company.
Thank you.
Because for me, it's almost impossible. No, it is impossible. Let's call it.
Golf is like go to market. We can draw some analogies of the foundations you need to build to get in.
Yeah. Now I'm in a tough spot.
But you know, the toughest part of this
I'll never get
is
a job.
In the golf industry, when you do SaaS in the golf industry, you have to think that a golf course in most region in North America, they do 80% of their revenue on 4 months. So they never switch software for half the year, right? So as a software company, we need to make sure that we sign them in a very close window of time. We need to make sure we spend enough so that we can get the growth that's going to get us to the next round of financing. But if we don't, our next iteration is not a month. The next iteration is a year from now.
Yeah.
So I think the reason we were so deep into revenue architecture was out of constraint as well. That's because if we missed one iteration, the next one was 360 days after. And when you're VC backed, you have that pressure to grow. So you want to make sure that you don't miss it.
Yeah, they're used to seeing like month over month growth in a startup. And you're like, okay, we're going to grow through the winter and then come back to that. So
precisely. Yeah.
Where is Vasco in terms of fundraising at this point? Where are you in the journey?
The good news is actually my CTO and co-founder was the CTO and co-founder of ChronoGolf, my first company as well. So we have a relationship that dates back 2010. So I think the team was a compelling team for investors, and we had clear founder market fit. So we're able to second time entrepreneurs as well to raise a very nice pre-seed funding. So what we decided is we wanted to start with a bit of capital just to make sure that we have sufficient resources to hire great engineers. When you're trying to build a new category product, serving a new profession, which is revenue operation, the product needs to be kind of deep. And we wanted to make sure that we can attract senior talents and bring the best engineers on board. So we raised the pre-seed round 18 months ago, something like that. And we've been building the product since, going out slowly out of stealth mode in the past 2 months to start more on the go-to-market side. We wanted to make sure that we had a great product that was iterated with a few cohorts of early users before we start to get out there and show it to the world. So that's what we've been doing for a few months now.
Very exciting to be coming out of stealth mode. Do we want to dive into the demo? And
let's do it. I can't wait to see.
All right. So maybe before I go deep into the product, Vasco is, again, like the end-to-end revenue operation platform for people who have revenue architect minds. And what the product does is really six big things, right? You can set up your go-to-market motions and visualize your bow tie. So your go-to-market motions are basically the, you know, an ICP on which you dedicate an entire team to go after within a customer journey. It's a concept that has been brought and popularized by Winning by Design. And it's really what we enable to do within the product. And then visualize the bow tie, which is basically from lead to LTV, what's happening within your revenue engine. And then we go deeper and we help you build revenue forecast and capacity planning, actual mapping, data integration, data enrichment. And we have a full BI platform so you can build your own reports afterwards. So the premise of Vasco is we believe that every B2B businesses have their prospect follow a customer journey. And the best businesses in the world are the ones that really architect and organize their organizations around that customer journey. So they specialize team to make sure that they lift channels and prospects to move from one step to the next on the customer journey. And by specializing people around clear metric system, you can bring predictability, but you can also increase velocity. And the metric system is almost always the same for companies, even though you can sometimes customize the naming, but it's going from awareness to education, to selection, to closing, and then materializing the LTV through onboarding, retention, and expansion. The entire game is basically maximizing the volume of inputs that goes in each and every of those boxes, the conversion rates, and then reduce the time and stage. And when you do that progressively by, again, specializing teams on various channels and go-to-market motions, then you can really bring that velocity together. So Vasco, what we'll do is we'll enable you to build all your channels, funnels, go-to-market motions, and so on. And then we'll integrate it with your tech stack, so your CRM, Salesforce, HubSpot, or your HR system. And then we'll power you that kind of view. So this is an example, but it's the visualization of the performance of your organization placed on the customer journey. So if I were to really look at this, this is, you know, the bow tie that most people know that come from the Winning by Design team. And by the way, we're certified by Winning by Design. We have a partnership with them and we're certified partners. So every formula calculations and things like that are consistent with their methodology. But you can see really what's going on with your engine. So if we were to look at this very quickly, for instance, you can see that you got more leads than you expected in the beginning. But as you progress through the engine here, your conversion rates have been lower than expected between SQL and SAL. And even though your win rate was great, you didn't get enough closed one at the end of the funnel. And when you really look at that and you view each and every step of your customer journey this way, then you can really define who's accountable and where the engine is fixing. And here, it's very, very clear. It's between that stage, the selection phase, so, you know, the transition and the handoff between SQLs and SAL. And then you can even dive in by channel so that you can really define, you know, the channels that are providing the best ROIs or the ones that are more complicated. You can also have various metrics that tell you on the left side of the bow tie what are the channels that are performing the best. So here you can see that, for instance, paid advertising has been lower than expected. So maybe this is where you need to reduce a bit the budget and investing elsewhere until you refine formula. But for instance, other campaigns and organic and SEO had a better performance, so they deserve a bit more investment. The right side of the bow tie as well, with, you know, net revenue retention, expansion, and so on and so on, up until actually the teams and the target and the coverage. So here you have all the forecasts, the actuals, and you can see, well, outbound SDR, they were supposed to do 264 SAL, they only did 94. Let's dive into that. And then you can really see and really dive into each of the numbers and the performance by individual. And if you see that you're actually needing to add more people so that you can get your coverage on track, then Vasco also helps you manage your workforce and build targets and forecasts. So it's really that 360 that you get on your entire go-to-market engine so that you can make more educated decision. And when you're running those QBR, those monthly business review, those weekly business review, you get the real view of where the accountability should lie and what you should be focusing on, rather than trying to only rely on anecdotal feedback so that you can find how to improve and perform. So that's one of the view. I'll pause here. Do you have potentially any questions?
Yes, there's a lot of questions. So I think I love the outline of the bow tie. I also tend to go that route when I'm at the company and I try to implement a new process and help to make a decision, you know, which way you want to go. Just curious, is there a way to create a reverse flow of the conversion rates needed in order to hit the target?
Yeah, so absolutely.
Because that's a typical use case that a lot of companies are struggling with, right? Like how much coverage I need in order to hit the number during the specific time horizon, right? Because that coverage will be different for the current quarter, next quarter plus one. So planning for that, is there a way to do this?
Yeah, actually, this is the actuals that we connect from your various tech stack, but this is the forecast. And the forecast is the forecast that is built with the forecasting engine of Vasco. So the first thing you do when you get to Vasco is you'll set up your customer journey and how your function go. Because to build your forecast, you need to define what your channels are and who's responsible for those channels. So you set up the customer journey. This is an example of one customer journey. You can have changes as well in the future where you have marketing sending MQLs from those various channels to inbound SDRs that are sending, you know, pipeline sales accepted leads to account executives and so on. This is no code mapping, right? I could say, for instance, that marketing would send SQLs and this would adjust all the way we digest the data and help you build your forecast. So once you've built this, then we have the structure and then you can go on the top down. And when you go on the top down, let me pull the forecast here. The first thing you're going to be forecasting is understanding how much you need to grow by when. This is typically where the CEO, the CRO, and the CFO come together and say, okay, we need to grow by X amount so that we can raise the next round of financing or hit the next milestone. So here we have a very simple explanation, you know, with the beginning MRR and you add your new MRR, you add your churn and so on. And let's say you want to grow from $90,000 of beginning MRR to $357,000. Okay. So that means that now we understand the basic assumptions that gets you there. But where you were asking me is, so now how do I reverse engineer that growth into how many leads, MQL, SQL, and so on I need to hit so that actually my engine is not broken? And this is where Vasco helps you to get a little deeper. So we have configured all those channels. You define how much they're going to contribute. And in Vasco, you know, if I take this example here, we'll ask you, okay, so what's your current MRR for organic and SEO? What are your conversion rate through the various stages of the funnel? Lead to MQL, MQL to SQL, SQL to SEL, and so on and so on. And what are your time in stage? If you need to get an amount of closed one in a certain months and you have sales cycle, then it means that the pipeline need to be generated in advance. So we cohort that for you. And as we do that, then Vasco is going to tell you exactly how many leads, MQLs, SQLs, SAL, and customer one you need to do through the funnel, cohorted with your timing stage, so that you give yourself the chances of getting your micro goal, which is to grow from $90,000 to $350,000 of MRR. And now that you know this, then your bottom up and the targets of your team, they become mathematical because you've said, for instance, that outbound SDR is in charge of this channel outbound, right? From the top down, we know that in January, cohorted, you need to generate 25 sales accepted leads, 18 in February, March in 21. Again, this is connected to your top down planning. You put a little buffer, and then that gives you the targets, a target that is really related to your plan. And then what you do is you get into that function, you add your people, and then you add their targets, and then you try to make sure that that coverage here, which is what you were referring to, the sum of the targets of all individuals, reach 100% so that you know the capacity of your team is enough so that you give your chance to get your goal. Here, for instance, we're lacking coverage, so basically sending the team on a death march. So you might consider just adding people and hiring, and then you would have your people and you would define their targets and so on. And once they go here, then you can add their quota. And if you add their quota, then it's going to adjust the coverage, and you can make sure that you build your hiring plan in order to fit what the goal of the company are.
Yeah, I think it's super helpful when you try to justify the expense, right? Because very often is that, you know, you go to your CFO and you talk to them and say, you know, I need more headcounts. Well, and then why you need them? Well, here's why I need them, right? And this is an easy way to really make this connected and see, you know, where the gaps are coming from, and also review the assumptions, because that's a big part of that forecast that you just walk us through, right?
Typically, CFO, they want to see numbers. I think Vasco kind of bridges the conversation gap that you have between the CRO and the CFO by giving the arguments for the CRO to mathematically justify why he's asking for budget. And here we're talking about the main plan, but you know, most of the time you'll have the CEO says, okay, I want to have a plan where we don't grow by 40% year over year, we go by 60% year over year. And Vasco, through that method, will tell you, okay, this is the new plan. Perfect. This is how much it's going to cost you. This is how many hire you will need to get at which part of the funnel.
Spot on. Which part of the funnel? And I think you can just weight this between the different scenarios, right? So I see here you have a, you know, multiple functions or roles, right? And you can argue, okay, maybe I want to hire someone and they will do the SDR outreach, right? But based on these numbers, you can hire someone in partnership and get maybe a little bit smaller deal, higher volume in a shorter period of time. That's a good trade-off, right? And that's kind of the merit of the conversation that the RevOps can facilitate together with finance, you know, for the CFO and the CRO to agree on which direction they should go. I like that, and because I've been there. So, and you don't have to be a CFO to ask the questions about numbers. I'm asking the numbers. I'm always asking about numbers.
Absolutely. And most of the time, the CFO view typically is, I think I heard Lizzie says, by function, right? And most of the time, I think the CFO and FP&A view stops at account executive, which is basically how many people and what are their quota you need to hit so that you can get the top line. But if you don't have the pipeline, if you don't have the MQLs, if you don't have the things that have been on the left side of the bow tie that are there, then you don't have enough to feed those account executives. And you can, in theory, think that you're covered, but the reality is that you will not generate the pipeline that is needed so that the customer journey doesn't break.
Yeah, I agree. It's all about three things. First is the baseline. Another one is the stretch.
Yes.
And the third one is the actions you're going to take in order to bridge the gap. Because, you know, the stretch is always something that is more aspirational than really you can expect the team to really deliver. And then you have to create a plan that actually will get them to that stretch area from the baseline that they operate, right? And so some companies just overshoot and not deliver because they didn't create the action plan, or the stretch was so far off from the baseline, or the baseline was too low, right? And they overachieved even though they could go a little bit further. So classic sandbagging case. But I think here you can have a visibility, and also you bring a lot of transparency off the shelf, connecting a couple of things together, right? You have a process, you have a metrics that are getting impacted, you have a headcount, so cost planning, and then you can have a relation between the top line and the cost. Because I saw on your landing page, there was a cost category, and I was just wondering whether this is a CAC or this is a total spend. How do you structure this? But I think it's helping to connect all these pieces together.
You have the entire costs that it can put. We work very, very, very hard also to build an attribution of cost that is really precise to the channel level or to the go-to-market motion level. Most of the time I see companies building budget and cost, but you know, doing very, very rough aggregation of those costs. And in reality, your LTV of a CAC, your CAC payback, your unit economics metric, they're only accurate at the company level, but they don't provide your insights at the channel level or the go-to-market motion level. And I've been in Santa Cruz for a Winning by Design conference, and this is what they've been really advocating. I fully agree with this. It's great to have those unit economics at the company level, but it doesn't tell you where you need to accelerate or decelerate. You may have a couple of channels, for instance, paid social, where you've been spending $5 million and that has an LTV of a CAC of 0.5x. This is actually an example I saw in a company. And they don't realize it because they've only been looking at LTV over CAC at the company level, and it was 3x, and people were thinking that, okay, we can still continue to accelerate. And now that we are at a time where capital has become a bit more expensive and sustainable growth has become kind of the theme that's coming up, understanding where you win and where you should be allocating resources has become absolutely critical, I think, for those startups if they want to raise a Series B, Series C, Series D.
Yeah. Doing LTV to CAC by channel is very hard. And you're working with like the finance team to get the costs. And then you're going in and trying to like marry this data together. This tool to me takes a bunch of spreadsheets, a bunch of CRM reports, a bunch of financing reports and puts them all on one platform. And so your analytics team is no longer trying to get data together, but they actually can go in and start like analyzing that data. I am curious how long it takes a company to set this up. Like how much are you just pre-populating data from the CRM versus getting individuals to say, here's what the budget is and here's what this is?
It's a great question. It's actually, we've been, as you know, in stealth mode for a few months trying to build a product that would really resonate with an early cohort of users. And it really makes sure that we transform those users into references. And the big realization that we had is as we went to market with what I've shown, then we said, yes, we just have to connect to your CRM and we'll get the data. And then magically, you're going to get all those numbers that are going to come in. And then we had our first realization as a startup, which is that we actually couldn't bring our first customers live because their CRM data was messy, like 99% of the company out there. And we entered a world where we're like, wow, we need to clean the CRM data so that we can actually construct that data model that you can report on and then get all the features that you want, which are the reports, the insights, the LTVs of a CAC and things like that. But getting them live was the challenge. And out of constraint, actually, we had to build a module inside Vasco, which is the radar module. And this has become the first value of Vasco and the thing that people buy first. So in Vasco, you can connect your various sources. Then we have a no-code mapping. So you have that metrics and basically you decide for all those metrics. Tell me what an MQL is in your CRM. It's a contact that has this date, this is the quota attribution, and then you can add as many conditions as you want. So no code mapping, this and that you can do within 10 to 15 minutes. But then you ingest the data from the CRM, and then we realize that actually there is a lot of things that don't go well. Let me give you a few examples. Channels on the contact object are different than channels on the deal object. They use a different list for one and a different list for the other. You realize that actually there are a lot of duplicates from the same company and you think you have five MQLs, but actually it's just one because it's one company, but you're using the contact object at this. And therefore your conversion rates look very, very bad, but it's just because you have a ton of duplicates. You have half of your contacts that don't have the fields that are required to put in place that model. So what we've done is two things, and it's actually the thing that people now buy in the first place. We've built Radar. Once you ingest the data in your CRM, we give you that integrity score and we tell you everywhere where you have holes in your CRM so that you can actually implement the model, the infrastructure, the architecture to build the bow tie. And then we classify them for you and we give you clear insights of where they are. And then, for instance, you can say 117 events. We cannot track them precisely because we are missing an owner. Then we show you all the events that are there. And then you can double click on each and every one of them. And then you even have, you know, a deep connection in the CRM. And what is that it has done? We've gamified getting the CRM cleaner, but also we've enabled more junior team to really look where to find things to fix and given them a structure on how to build that data hygiene. And we've also done some enrichments like deduplication, autofill of stages that are missed and things like that so that we've reduced that time to get ready to now it's a few hours for our customers actually.
Yeah, this is a great product on its own. And what I like about it is like, obviously the sales team is going to be excited about the first product, the real Vasco that you built. And now you're getting the RevOps team also very excited about buying this product.
I need to say it. I think it's the most elegant way to call someone's bullshit. I love it, right? Like if somebody's not doing the proper pipeline hygiene, there you go. Your score is not looking good. You have to do your work. Go back to basics. putting the right attribution around these opportunities, leads, contacts, whatever it is, in order to have a great output, right? Have a good readout. Otherwise, you won't look good. You will never look good.
100%. And if you want to build a diagnostic to know where you need to fix the engine and build trust with your board, with your investors, with the executives, well, you need to have that data that you can trust to come here. And I don't think there's any excuse for any company that's VC-backed or even not VC-backed to actually build that data model, because this is basically, you know, the heart of your business, the core of the decision-making process. If you don't want to rely solely on anecdotal feedback that are coming from the last week of sales, this is the way to go. And funny enough, we were again at this conference with Winning by Design, which we believe build an amazing framework, and they're great at evangelizing that methodology. But you could see from the crowd that one of the biggest hurdles for adoption of that framework was, I have dirty data in my CRM, therefore I don't know where to start. And for us, we had to build actually that module, which is now almost the first thing that they buy, so that actually they can build the first foundation to get there. And we help them along the way.
Winning by Design must be a great partnership go-to-market motion for you, I'm hoping, in the future, because we had Winning by Design come in and train us, and it's great. It's great training. And then you're kind of like, okay, where do we start? And now they have a product that they can be like, here's the tool to help you go and do it step by step.
100%. We are very close. We are working very closely together.
This is awesome. I have more questions, but we got to move on. Let's talk about, who are you selling this to? What is your go-to-market strategy? Where are you going from here?
Right now, our first customer, the range between 1 million of AR to 100 million of AR. We are solely for SaaS. We decided to go for SaaS initially. I don't know what you think, but I think this applies, this methodology, not just to SaaS, to any B2B business that is selling even services to other businesses. But we decided to go with one vertical and niche that we knew to make sure we solve very, very well for them and go very deep. And our ICP ranges between 1 million of AR to 100 million of AR. Those are kind of the customer range that we have. I'd say the sweet spot is between 5 million when you start to have a few AEs and you start to fill the hurdle a bit more, up to 50 million and more.
You could do this for advertising too. Me and Demetrius have both worked at a SaaS advertising business, and it's still an issue to figure out where things are coming from. So there's lots of future potential there. Is anyone else really doing this? Do you have competitors in this space?
I think the first thing I saw in the market is it's a new category. It's crazy to think about it, but RevOps didn't exist 4 years ago. Now it's a $3.6 billion industry, and it's forecasted to grow 18% year over year for the next 10 years. The last prediction I saw was RevOps is expected to be $18 billion in 10 years from now. Half of it being services. Why? Because it's so hard to recruit people in RevOps that now you have all those agencies that are popping everywhere so that they can give the service to the people who actually need it. And I always wonder, like, how come this is having that trajectory in a world where go-to-market team are going smaller, revenue operation is actually growing bigger, and people have a hard time recruiting. And I don't know if you have seen the same thing than me, but I trace it back to, with software going on the cloud, now you don't need an army of field sales to start selling your product. Therefore, you could start specializing role. And you could bring some things that were unique to B2C, which was iterating various channels on various things. Now you can do that for B2B because you don't need actually feet on the floor. And that has, you know, started the first wave. But there was always that blocker with, at a certain deal size, you need to shake the hand of someone and you need to physically meet that person. And that has gone with COVID. And as COVID has lifted that mass barrier, now everybody has adopted or tried to adopt that model where you specialize teams around the customer journey and you get really more like a revenue factory rather than a sum of, you know, people. And people have lost view from lead to cash. And as a consequence, they've thrown humans and bodies at the problem. And they took people from the organization and put them in a very strategic role, which is revenue operations, that owns now understanding what's happening within the revenue engine and building back that formula. And right now, the way they do it is they do it through extract in spreadsheets and reconstructing a static view of that reality. And they're kind of heroes, you know, because they're being asked to do a zillion things often last minute and with a ton of constraints and a ton of assumptions. And I mean, I've been building some of those models in my first startup. When you have someone telling you, okay, can you model me if we add one channel here and we change that function from there to there? And you're sweating because you know it's like 4 days of work because the model has been built with just an this way to go and this is that. So those people right now, like I would say the biggest competitor we fight against is still Microsoft Excel because it's a new category and it's what people are using to get there.
Yep.
Then you have all the tools that have been built for finance, by finance people, FP&As and so on. I would say those are the mosaic or the pigment of this world. And they do a great job to help FP&A teams. But they're not there when it's really understanding like the revenue factory lead to MQL, MQL to SQL and so on, conversion rate, channels, really revenue architecture. They're more like I'm taking closed one and I'm outputting financial statements and P&L and cash. So it's a side competition when the CFO takes control of this. But when you have a strong scientific minded CRO or has a rev up teams, then this is not a solution they go after. And then like every new, you know, businesses, I'm happy we're seeing a few startups that are starting there. And I think it's great because it means that the model is becoming popular and then people understand that this kind of product is needed. I do believe we have the best product. Obviously, I am biased about it, but I've been living the pains. And But it's exciting because there's more of us than actually are evangelizing that market.
When you're in a new category, it's always nice to see competitors pop up, right? Like, you know, you're doing something right, but you're really fighting against the status quo, essentially, of like what has been done and can a tool come in and do this? You talked a little bit about you're starting to go to market. And I mentioned the Winning by Design as a potential good partnership. Well, one, are you using your own tool to do your go to market? And then what channels are you looking up to really invest in?
Yeah. So it's amazing because with Vasco, actually, we're using Vasco to measure the progress of Vasco on Vasco. And first of all, I feel that Vasco is the first tool that I use personally, the first reflex now to understand what's happening in my go-to-market engine. I think that's great. And it means that we've touched something that is very important because I get the data that I trust in the right format. And I'm sure that it's what helps me drive insights. So we use Vasco in every WBR, QBR, monthly business reviews, and things like that. It's also an amazing forcing function to make sure that we build a product that we love and like and that resonates with the customer. Because as we have to use it, we're making sure that if we feel frustration when we use it, that we solve for it. So
fix it. Yep. You know,
it's a bit like a CRM company using their own CRM. It's the same here. So we do that. And the channels that are working right now, inbound is great. We're starting just to get out in the market. And there's actually an active need of people that are trying to build that view of the bow tie that they try to reconcile within various spreadsheets. And they see Vasco as something that is going to give them much more insights, but also give them time back to their day. And then the other pieces is I'm receiving leads from revenue operation agencies who are using Vasco on behalf of their customers, VC companies who would love their portfolio companies to be more mature around their go-to-market motion, and third-party agencies that are really there. So it's great. We do just a little bit of outbound, but right now it's mostly referrals and inbound. And I think that speaks to the fact that there is a need for that kind of tool.
Yeah, I think, you know, we dabble in the world of services and talk to a lot of services agencies. And a great way to get referral is you're already working with the agency. Oh, let us help you implement this tool. So that seems like a really smart way to be going to market. You showed us a few of your integrations, so HubSpot, Salesforce, and was it Workday and Bamboo? Are you working on any other integrations? Are you seeing like a need to pull other data into the platform?
Yeah, right now we've built our integration so that if we were to add another CRM, it just takes us a couple of days. So we've built that as an abstract layers, and it's just this, you know, extracting the data. Everything has been built in a very scalable manner. But we also realize that in our ICP right now, 90% of the market is either using HubSpot or Salesforce. So we can, if you're using Pipedrive, Close.io, like we can easily get you on board. It's just that it was never needed so far. The world where we're going to get a bit more two worlds, we are going to be more integrating with the NetSuite of this world or the Xero or the QuickBooks so that we can get also the automation of costs going through. And we're also seeing a lot more of those companies who've actually invested in a Snowflake interface or any data warehouse we actually build a data warehouse for you with Vasco, but some of them come with their existing data warehouse and they've ingested the data and they are understanding that it's actually quite hard to transform that data, to build the SQL queries and to actually transform that raw data into something actionable. So what we're going to be doing as well is integrate with those data warehouse. And even though you've done the ingestion part, we'll still give you the radar view so that you understand how to build this and all the prepackaged revenue forecasting, planning, and insights out there. But it was a big surprise. I don't know if you see that as well, but now I'm seeing like almost half of the startups that are between 5 to 15 million, and they've already spinned out a snowflake in the face that is somewhat living on the side and as being a long-term project. Yeah, let's put it this way.
Yeah, on our B2B side of a business, a lot of people have integrated and invested in Snowflake. And sometimes the question comes up, like, what are you doing with that data? Dimitris, you might have different thoughts here. I think some companies do it better than others. But especially as you move up market, that makes a lot of sense to do those integrations.
Precisely, yeah.
I think these integrations are giving a lot of opportunities for you, a lot of use cases. It's the question how the company really defines them. And often is that, you know, it's like this, the first step is missing. Well, you have already step 2 and 3. That's why they struggle, right? It's almost like how to monetize data. It's the same question, right?
100%.
Just companies have a lot of data, but they just don't know how to monetize it because these use cases either don't exist or nobody defined them. And the same case is here. Going back to your point, Guillaume, about the financial integrations, that's a big one. That's where the product becomes an overarching or glue-like application between the teams. Today, the finance or FP&A versus operations, they're still operating in a silo way, right?
I agree.
It's part of it is the data confidentiality. I don't think everything should be available to operations, right? For a lot of reasons. But I think the teams need to be a little bit more outgoing and share more between each other, so that they not only build the trust, but also they have a better insights. You know, part of my work often is, okay, how do I work with finance, right? That's part of my experience. You know, I'm coming from finance, right? That's where I started my career. So I'm always sensitive to that. And they're getting surprised. Oh, I have a guy on the other side that actually speaks our language. But there's a very different conversation when you have a tool that can facilitate this in a very simple way. We can have a very specific conversation about little details that will create the better picture of what is going on, right? So that's why I think, you know, getting and tapping into that part of the integrations, it's a super important for that tool. And what I think will just give a lot of additional insight because you have already use cases, right? Like your use cases already exist.
And what we've built is really right now the model so that you can manually enter the cost and you'll get all the detail of the insights, the KPIs like CAC payback, LTV of a CAC or magic number or all those KPIs, but you still need to fill in those costs manually. So the bridge that we still need to do is, you know, as you mentioned, is integrate with those tools so that you get them real time and you reduce that manual entry. It's funny, I didn't know you had a financial background. I also have a financial background. I studied finance. I have a master in accounting and finance, and then I went in entrepreneurship and in product. But it's funny, in organizations, people assume that the only ones who actually do understand numbers are the financial teams, and therefore they have a lot of power in making decisions that are based on their understanding of the world. But their understanding of the world is most of the time what's happening between closed one to cash collected to P&L creation. But how you manufacture growth is, well, it's as important, even more important, because this is how you produce those numbers. And I feel that I was always able to convince people around me because I could speak the financial language like you can.
Yeah.
But if you can't, you often end up losing arguments even though you're right, just because you can't justify it with intuitions, which never go very well with people who prefer numbers.
Yeah, I had a conversation the other day about getting an approval on a new referral commission with finance. Yep. And like, hey, can we get this? And she was like, well, can we stop the program anytime we want? And I was like, well, you could, but you wouldn't want to do that because you're going to hurt all these partnerships. And it was just this conversation of like, she is just in the numbers and I'm in the relationship of like, why you would make this decision or not. And like, how do you start to close that gap? Well, I say, look at, we've had these referral partnerships. They've driven X amount of revenue and it's only cost us this much. And that's where a tool like Vasco can come in and I can just show her the numbers, right? Yeah.
100%. Very happy to make a demo and have you as customers.
Yeah. I think you said something very important about the numbers. And I always tell this to my go-to-market partners. Most of the conversations around deciding whether you're going to make money is with the people that are fluent with money. No matter where you go and you have conversations about investments, more headcounts, more campaigns, more anything, you need to be able to translate all of that, whatever that is, into the money, right? And that's a bottom line. So going back to our previous point about, you know, how to connect this and how valuable it is, I think it's not only option, it should be a paradigm of these conversations internally in the go-to-market teams. If I do this, what it means in terms of spending and the return. Bottom line, that's it, right? And yeah. I think a lot of sales leaders, marketers, customer success leaders, they are excellent in what they do. And they are very often opportunistic, rightfully so. But I think they are struggling to translate this into what it means for the company, right? Every single one of them can claim, I'm going to do XYZ. I need that much money. And this is what you get. But they don't really see the full picture. You have all these requests that are coming to you and you have to translate them into money and see where you're going to allocate the money because you don't have enough to give them all the same of what they're asking for, right? It's just my expansion of what you just said about having that financial mindset while you're talking or you're talking about something or you're talking to someone about something.
I fully agree. You know, the new analogy that exists in the market right now is that go-to-market on high-velocity companies are like revenue factories. And revenue factories means that basically you have different stations on which you're trying to optimize to go faster and faster. And right now, most of those factories are operated with Excel spreadsheet that give you kind of view statically at the end of the quarter. And there is no way to course correct through the quarter, through the months, or it requires efforts for a ton of people and hours and so on just to compile through spreadsheets. You wouldn't think or believe that Toyota would run their factory using Excel spreadsheets. But right now, CROs and RevOps team, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And in the world where we're living in, like it changes so fast, you need to adjust on the spot. You need to get the signals on the spot. You need to stop the factory line on the spot to get there. You need to understand what are the bottlenecks on that factory plan that slows down the rest of the engine. And there is one thing also, it's something that is not spoken too much about, but is this is also coming from Winning by Design. So I'm going to take their word, but I fully agree with it, is that you have different revenue factory line based on your different ICPs or your different go-to-market motions. You wouldn't think about Tesla having the same factory line for their Model X, their Model S, and their Model 3, and their Model Y, right? It's different factory lines, different product also that are being produced differently. And right now, people are trying to fit every ICP, every region, and all into one factory line. And most of the time, that's why they start to stop growing around 8 to 12 million of AR, because they've been targeted a certain type of ICP that are the active buyer on the market for that type of product. And they say, but my time, my total addressable market is huge. Yes, your time is huge, but your time goes through that channel in that region for that type of use case. It is 3% of your time. And right now you're at market saturation for that. So you need to spin out new production line, so that you can, I don't know, start an outbound motion, go in more geographies, go more, you know, mid-market versus SMBs and so on, but you need to measure them. And that's one of the main reasons I think scale-ups start to die, is because they don't spin out different go-to-market motion. Or when they do, it's a small attempt and everybody looks at the number aggregately and then you don't know why your conversion rate go down, but you're like, yes, but you're trying to get go-to-market fit on a new factory. Like you won't build a new factory to produce a product, good or services, and it would be immediately working. Like you produce it, kind of work, and then you refine, and then it becomes a powerhouse. And those conversations, they're a bit too complex and people refuse complexity, but this is the way you actually go from $10 to $100 million of AR, I think.
Yep.
And it's unfortunate because so much die just because they don't do that. Anyway.
So that's a very good point. Don't you think that what you just described maybe created the PLG notion on the market, like product-led growth, that is somehow trying to give companies a validation around the product fit before they start scaling because of a lot of those failures, right? They were thinking, you know, we're going to do this the old way or a way that somebody did somewhere some time ago.
Yeah.
But the market, like you said, is getting more complex faster, and you need a lot of validation data before you start committing into something like that, because that's a capital intense approach, right? If you start adding 20 sales reps, 20 SDRs, marketers, that's a very expensive model, especially if you don't have a product validation fit.
I'll have another angle at it just for fun. I think PLG is a phenomenal go-to-market motion. It works extremely well. It's highly scalable because you use the product, people get live much quicker, and it means you don't need to hire a lot of people, and it's a great way to validate an initial fit. PLG also was a great way for founders that don't like to sell and don't like to learn how to sell to get to market and get something that works because, well, you know, their forte is building product, and therefore the product should speak for itself, and this is where it goes. Mm-hmm. PLG is phenomenal. It's great. It should work. But if you're selling a 100K ACV deal, PLG will 95% of the time never work. You need to find the go-to-market motion that fits with the kind of customer you're going after. At 100K per year, your product is expected to have services. People are expected to convince internally complicated structure. They want to look at contracts. The person who makes the buying decisions needs to agree with finance, compliance, CFO, budget, and so on and so on. And that requires sales effort. And they don't just buy the product. They also buy the services. So you coming in and making sure that the implementation of the product is going to be a success. So your go-to-market motion should not be what you prefer to do. Your go-to-market motion should be what is the most logical versus the kind of market you're going after and the type of deals that you're going after. If you're in the 50K side, you can do inbound and a bit outbound. But if you're selling to Fortune 500 companies, forget about PLG.
Yeah.
If you're selling to, you know, less than 1,000K ACV per year, then adding an outbound team will make you scale unprofitably in terms of unit economics. So I think the go-to-market motion should be the result of who's your ICP and what your product does, rather than, oh, everybody said PLG is the way to go, we should do PLG.
Yeah, I think even like something that came up for me as you were talking about that and building a new product and figuring out how to go to market with it. I think what the tool does, or something companies need to be doing more of, is just looking at like, do we need a new product to make more money? Or are we just not doing the current product correctly? Like, are there things we can fix that is right here and we just invest in that a little bit more? Or do we need to shut down a product that isn't a product market fit? And I think seeing all of those layers can really help. Often you have like a product team saying, this is a great product, and you have a sales team saying, we can't sell it. And so then you can start to dig into why is that and where are we falling down here?
I fully agree.
So what's next for Vasco? Where do you want to take it from here?
At risk of looking like every startup company is going to say that, it's time for us to unlock the AI vision of the product. But let me remove the kind of everybody speaking about AI because it's great for marketing side of thing is, if we go back to what Vasco has done in the past few months, is we've taken a very complex world that has a lot of unstructured data, and we've restructured it so that we offer a data model on which you can look at your revenue engine. Then that data was very unclean. So we built a product so that you can easily clean that data. So now you have a normalized, very clean data set that you can start to play with, mostly manually by building scenarios and other things. So the next part of our roadmap is actually to start making that data or that data set dense a little more. So getting more signals on things that are different versus before. You can use also solvers. You want to build a scenario that says, I want to grow by not 30%, but 50% year over year. Tell me exactly where I should invest, who I should hire, in which position, for what kind of quota. This is something that is doable with the current structure. And continuing with data enrichment, making sure that we get more data that is valuable for those companies and that we collect it for them without requiring their manual inputs, like geography, verticals, company size, types of industries, and things like that. So it's really going to be investing in taking that product that we've built and automated using various things that AI enabled to do in various branches of AI.
As we were going through the product, I was wondering, like, where do recommendations and insights come in of, like, what is actually possible here? And that's where predictive AI...
This is what we'll be attempting in the next 6 to 12 months.
That's very exciting. This, we're to our kudos section. So any other companies that you want to call out that you think are doing really cool things in the space?
Yeah. So for me, in the kudos section, I could be speaking about various. There's one that I know and I really love. The company name is called Vessel, V-E-S-S-E-L. They're providing a tool to democratize investment in the private markets. So they've started and they've built a tool for all venture capital companies and funds out there to help with their fundraising and enable the ability for individuals to invest in those as LPs in those VC and private equity funds. Private markets have been very inaccessible for most companies, and it requires a ton of legal structuration and blah, blah, blah. They've abstracted that complexity and they've made it easy for any individual with certain thresholds, but to access to private markets, which have a better return profile than public market. There is the risk component, but
risk and reward.
Yeah. Yes.
Always that. Okay. What are the top three tips you have for a go-to-market community?
I will start with one that is really for the funders out there. What you've heard in that podcast applies only if you have product market fit. If you don't have product market fit, go find product market fit and do things that don't scale. Once you have product market fit, then it's about getting to go to market fit. And then everything you've heard here apply, and we're there to help. But please do not think that you can overshadow product market fit by just applying a more brutal sales motion or trying to implement high sales velocity, because otherwise churn is going to come back at you and you're just building too much debt in the future that you're going to have to pay back as the company was slowed down. So that's one. The second tip is really for those companies who fund product market fit is to start building the model in their CRM so that they can start measuring things. And as they measure things, to specialize team within their go-to-market motion. It's very simple, but it's again for the people who are selling from 1 to 10 million. If you're asking your salespeople to do expansion, closing, and prospection, they have three goals. Two of them are going to take a second seat every single month. And you never know why, but pipeline generation is going to go down when they spend time closing. Expansion is going to grow up, but then closing is going to go down. And when you have a bit of pipeline generation, then you don't have enough deals. And because they focus on three things, none of them left, and it takes them 18 months to become fully proficient at those. So as soon as possible, try to specialize teams so that you, as the architect of the growth of that company, you reduce ramp-up time and you really fix the engine as they go. And the last one is please, 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 please start with lead generation and pipeline generation. Because if you build a predictable lead formula that brings you predictable pipeline in a channel and an ICP that works, close rates are going to follow, especially if you can demonstrate that you can feed good salespeople in. So most of them starts to say, well, let's hire an AE and it's going to do everything from A to Z. But actually, you validate more if you have found a way to get predictable pipeline. And you, as the founder, you continue to sell up until you can hire a salesperson and codify that formula. So that would be more for the startup side of things. Then for the scale up, reach 8 to 12 million. Make sure that if you try new things, that you spin out those experiments in different go-to-market motion. If you go after enterprise, your sales cycle are going to get longer. Your win rate is going to be smaller. You need a different skill set in terms of the people who actually do that. You sell differently. And if you don't do that and you just extract 15% of the time of your top seller and 20% of the time of a few marketers and BDRs to do that, it will never lift because people will revert back to what works and what they know and what's going to make them money in the short term. So if you really want to expand and open your go-to-market motion, it's like finding go-to-market fit again. You extract the team, you go at it, you measure it specifically, you iterate, and then you measure the core business differently than the rest of the business. Your VC will forgive you if this is not working immediately, but you show progress by better leads and you show that the core business is still healthy. What the VC will have a hard time is if you show them just declining conversion rates and extending sales cycle, but you don't know why. And it's just because you've opened up, I don't know, 2 to 3 go-to-market motion and you're just aggregating every number into one and you don't know whether or not the core business is at risk or it's the new bets that you've been putting.
That is some fantastic advice that I hope people listen to and take in for their own teams. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was amazing. It was great to hear your thoughts on the product, but then just on the industry in general.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thanks, Guillaume.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the RepTech Podcast. Please subscribe on the listening platform of your choice and leave us a review to let us know how we're doing.